Okay, so this is our sort of first national security podcast featuring people who write and analyze issues on national security, and this is our first podcast covering Grand Blog Tarkin, which is a sort of a roundtable of strategists, you know, discussing national security themes in science fiction, and I have the editor and sort of one of the writers on the blog, Kelsey, here, who can be found at the underscore boy Twitter.
Eventually there will be a better handle.
At the underscore. I really do enjoy reading your blog because it just, you sit there and you sort of look at science fiction, especially like Star Wars and sort of the latest post, which is Strategy and the Supervillain Problem, which we'll talk about. But how did you sort of become inspired, or how did you come to the sort of answer or the question that, you know, what does science fiction have to offer national security thinkers, or, you know, why science fiction as opposed to fantasy or any other genre?
Oh, as to start, first, the impetus for the blog came from a co-editor, Brett Friedman, who's a Marine at Quantico, currently figuring out how to lob explosives in the best way for national interest. and we realized that there are lots of places out there for people to discuss gunpowder and lead, for example, very serious strategy discussion, or Abu Mukawama. Is also another one that's very, very focused in real-world historical examples. But every now and then, we would find ourselves, often we'd see people tweeting, like, during Walking Dead or Homelander, or just anything, just watching, taking some fiction. Game of Thrones did a lot of it. So fantasy isn't excluded from Blog Tarkin. It just hasn't been there a lot yet. But there's, people were having very serious thoughts. You're drawing good parallels from fiction to reality, and we thought it would be a good idea to have a place to collect all of that, so it wasn't just someone has this random post on their otherwise serious blog that doesn't have a home. And so we've been able to create a home for a bunch of people. A bunch of people were already thinking about these things and writing it that way. And science fiction is just, it's good to have better metaphors or more metaphors or easy examples. It's a problem in most commentary that World War II is the war everyone references. It's either World War II or it's Vietnam, and those are the options you have to discuss war. And while Star Wars clearly isn't as serious, I think if we're allowed to bring Star Wars into it, we at least give us a third frame of reference.
Well, I mean, I think, like, Star Wars, I mean, you hit on the idea that it's really popular, everybody knows it, but it seems like the movies and then the expanded universe, like, they really do talk about problems that we're sort of experiencing now, sort of the idea that you don't need overwhelming firepower to really, you know, potentiate a political cause like the rebels did. Or in the case of, you know, the expanded universe, weapons can sort of, you know, if you have a capital, big ship that's, you know, able to access different planets, you don't necessarily need to have a huge constituency. You could just terrorize, you know, everybody in the submission or anybody. And it seems like those problems, you know, Saddam didn't have a spaceship, but he certainly, you know, understood the value of terror and political power.
Absolutely. I think there was, in the Sith Way of War, which was a post Brett Friedman wrote in response to an earlier one about the Jedi Way of War, but he drew very clear parallels between the Rebel Alliance and Al-Qaeda, which was heavy-handed and a bit overdone, but to stretch the point. But what you get is you have a very clear, smaller, asymmetric force trying to attack a stronger force. I think perhaps a better example would be not necessarily Al-Qaeda, but perhaps like the fighting in Iraq proper, or just broadly resistance movement. Or I think Syria might have been another good one. Anyway, what you have is a much smaller force figuring out how it can strike against a bigger enemy. And one of the things are hitting big capital ships, the Star or the Death Star is the biggest thing you could do with that. But we've seen small actors try and attack them already. The USS Cole tends to be forgotten.
Oh, right.
But that was a clear example of someone trying to drive away an occupying power by attacking their capital ship with a small force.
Well, I also say, like, especially the expanded universe, like the villain, Admiral Thrawn.
Yeah.
Like, I was reading Adam's post on the strategy and the supervillain problem, and he makes this really good point that, like, the supervillains that we can relate to are the ones that are realistic are basically gangsters, people who are seeking political power or profit, and not necessarily guys like the Joker and Luthor who are just like, I just want to watch the world burn. And, I mean, I was thinking about this earlier today, like, Star Wars really, you know, the villains are very, they're not, like, stereotypical supervillains. Like, with the exception, I would say, like, maybe Vader, but everybody else around him are either, you know, competent soldiers who are just fighting for a political cause, or they really, you know, don't want the rebels, you know, to challenge their hold on power.
Right, and as has been rightly pointed out many places, the awful as the government of the Empire was, they fixed a lot of problems with the Old Republic, or at least the Old Republic had a really crappy way of rule. It was not an effective system of governance. It didn't have, wasn't able to stop planets within it from fighting each other. It did. It had high powered. It had superhuman mediators who would go in and resolve the dispute and negotiate. The Jedi would go in and resolve the dispute. But that's a lot of really good peacekeeping missions that doesn't stop it from when a coalition, the Trade Federation in this case, decided to start attacking other planets. And what the Empire did is it built up a strong system. There was a power vacuum, and the Emperor filled it. Now, it's interesting you mentioned the Adam's piece on supervillain motivations, because we see things like, there are lots of minor supervillains who are, like, motivated by revenge, or not even necessarily supervillains, but of course Inigo Montoya is working for someone else, and he's clearly on a quest for revenge. Revenge is a personal quest that someone else, with a broader political aim, is able to turn to their purposes. Darth Vader is Star Wars's Inigo Montoya, if you will, to stretch every metaphor, but he is very clearly, the Emperor bends him to his will because he is trying, he has a grievance against the Jedi as a whole, and so, while that's not a political ambition itself, the Emperor, with a political ambition, is able to turn that to one, to a political purpose.
Kind of scary. I'm kind of interested on I keep reading the first post, or at least the latest one, on the supervillain problem, and I've been, My issue is when we move away from Star Wars and we start getting into, like, Game of Thrones, fantasy literature, and comic books, I wonder if you could still get those political insights. With Game of Thrones, it's kind of obvious, right? Because you have, you know, dragons don't equal political power, and, you know, always pay your bannermen, or pay heed to your bannermen. But, I mean, it seems like this post that Adam wrote, you know, you go back through the comic book literature, and it's just like, you know, why don't we ever meet Lex Luthor's lobbyists or lawyers? Like, why isn't he dismantling Superman this way? Why does it always, and it just seems that
my knowledge is lacking, but he does become president for some point.
He does, and then he goes around and he destroys Topeka, and I'm like, what? I'm just sitting there like, you became the most powerful man in the world, and you know, your rival, the superhero is Superman, who respects laws and respects order, and you're not, like, it just blows my mind that, like, it's, you know, the Star Wars world is able to keep it's realistic, like, within sort of the bounds of and understandings of our world, where, you know, the villains in comic books, you know, the Joker, I understand, he's crazy, he's, you know, he's supposed to be, like, sort of, you know, the chaotic, you know, contra to Batman's, you know, super order, but I just keep thinking, like, Lex Luthor, dude, you're Microsoft rich, like, you could just, you know, literally make Superman to look like a egomaniacal god, you know, mass murderer. But I never, anyway. I mean,
there are definitely, there are limitations of the medium, of some of them, certainly. One of the interesting pieces we did was Dana Susser wrote about it was Batman Incorporated, which was a very interesting thing DC did, which was a series of Batman decides that he's going to franchise out Batman as a Order of Justice, as a series of Supermen outside the bounds of law who go about and fight criminals or fight for justice in a sense that's not clearly in direct line with international law. And what was interesting about, there were a couple interesting things about that. One is that this was something DC did right before they decided to reset their continuity, which meant that DC was able to take this risk and go out of there without making what they thought would have been otherwise, like without permanently ruining the story, which is the problem with continuity, and especially continuity villains, is you need them, the hero and villain, to keep coming back order to make the story work, which doesn't really lend, which is limiting in the kinds of insight.
Batman's like a vigilante. Like, I never understood this. Like people view Batman as a hero, and then, you know, in the movies, like the second movie, they rightfully bring up, like, he's really a challenge to law and order, as much as, you know, the only difference between him and the Joker is that the Joker doesn't really care who he kills, whereas Batman sort of, you know, has rules of engagement. You know, it just seems like when we look at, like, superheroes, they really, all of them operate outside the law, and all of them sort of challenge the order they exist in. Whether they, you know, whether it's their purpose is good or bad doesn't really matter, because they sit there and say, you know, your policing is not good enough. Or, like, even in the case of Batman, like, he's sort of, I really like this about the Batman story, is that he creates the villains. Like,
right.
Like, the Joker is his creation, you know, and some of his other rogues galleries. Like, it seems like, you know, there's a superhero problem as much as there is a supervillain problem.
There absolutely is, and there's been a whole swath of, I want to say revisionist superhero history, that's wrong, but like modern tellings or problems that approach this, there's of course in Watchmen, superheroes are outlawed or contracted with the government, those are the only options. In Powers is a series where superpowers are outlawed, or the use of them are outlawed, and so it follows a police team that tracks down people still using powers.
Wasn't
terrible, ultra violent, but it's the story. It's a series called, I think, The Boys, which is
about,
which
Garth
is
Enos, where
Garth Enos doing his violent fantasy thing, where there's superheroes are a creation of like chemical super serum creation, and so, but they're out of the bounds of law, so they have to. The government keeps a small team of enforcers to keep them in line,
to kill them,
or to kill them when they go out of line. Really. Which all try and break it into a real sense, but superheroes provide a ton of problems for strategic and political thinking, which is why something like Star Wars, where the powerful people are the super powerful people are very few, gives you political systems to study instead.
No, I mean, that's what fascinates me. I've been watching the Justice League cartoon series. And it's really cool because, like, the series opens up with, like, basically the Earth has, everybody on Earth gives up their nuclear weapons, right? And so the rest of the series is this examination of where, you know, we give up our nukes, but then the Justice League steps in to maintain order. But then, like, later in the series, the government starts reacting and, you know, there's, you know, people start biting their nails and going, oh my gosh, you know, they have a satellite. Their base is a satellite that orbits the Earth, and they have a weapon pointing down. And it's just really fascinating because, you know, they don't... You get a feeling in the writing in the show, it's not really about truth, because you're shown week in and week out that, you know, Batman, Superman, the Green Lantern, whoever, they're doing good work. It's just that there's a perception, and they don't really maintain the... You know, they don't really try to dispel the perception that they're gods, or that they're, you know... One wrong step to the left, and you know it's the Justice Lords. They become, you know,
right,
the captains of the New Order, or whatever.
That was one of the really interesting things that the Avengers did, and I'm imagining will play out in the further Marvel films of the series, is that they managed to meld the whole, like, they build a collection of superheroes with a shadowy governmental organization, and what exactly government, it's not, S.H.I.E.L.D. is specified, or S.H.I.E.L.D. is vaguely or is superficially U.S., but not entirely, there's weird things, but it's a, but we are treating superpowered individuals as national weapons against alien invasion, is the kind of thing, and then there's the risk of power is what happens when you then create a autonomous weapon, if we want to actually go that direction, because that's where it goes.
It's not just an autonomous weapon, but one that is an alcoholic or has an ego. I mean,
or is alcoholic or is uncontrollable, or, okay, the one who relies on arrows we can quietly shrug off. We don't have to worry about him. But there's some
arrows. I'm out of arrows.
Which is why it's good to build constraints into your autonomous weapons. And this is the thing that we're talking about, and actually this ties in really nicely with, there's the Human Rights Watch just had a op-ed in the Washington Post recently about the fear of autonomous weapons or why we should test ban treaties, and there will be no weapon more autonomous than a person with a weapon.
Right. I mean, ever. Like, it seems like if, you know, to build this conversation to the real world, like, if you compare a nuke versus the AK-47, and the, you know, the individual has more control over the AK-47, you know, in terms of building, sales, and use, than a nuke. And it seems like, you know, when we talk about ultimate weapons, like, oh, you know, a nuke is, you know, huge, flashy, can level cities, but in reality, you know, the thing that's tied most closely to the individual is the one that gets used the most. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's sort of, you know, it's really, you know, the closer to the individual the weapon system is, or even in the case of the superhero, if the weapon system is the individual, it almost seems like it becomes more dangerous. You know, maybe.
It does, because then we're relying on, because we're relying on a weapon that can be used by one person, we're relying entirely on human psychology to control it. Whereas when we're relying on a nuclear weapon, there are so many protocols to go through, and granted, we've had close calls, but right, there are so many layers there where multiple people could say no and just stop it.
That's true. I mean, that's like what I really like about Iron Man is that in the comic books, he's portrayed as, he's an alcoholic. Like, he's a guy totally consumed by his monsters. And then you realize the alcoholic and the guy who has real, like, serious emotional problems also has a supersuit. And you're just like, you know, if this existed in real life, we'd all be messed. Like, I'm freaking out just thinking about it. Like, you know, it's not a guy with a drone, it's a guy with a rocket suit.
Right, absolutely. And in fact, in Iron Man 2, for all its flaws, has a fleet of drones that can be shut off. There are safeguards in the drones like there aren't in Iron Man, because he also built the suit. That's true. It would be one thing if someone else built the suit and programmed in the code to stop him, if he was just the pilot of a vehicle. But, yeah. But that's how you get the interplay there, is we're looking at, because Justice League deals with
protection.
It deals with protection. It deals with order maintained outside, which is something what one world government people fear. And what happens when you have, when you concentrate sufficient power in individuals who aren't controlled? That, honestly, the fears you could express, that people express about Justice League with their space laser, could be expressed, or were expressed, about terrorists getting WMD. It's the what happens when a small group with an ideological purpose that isn't in currently in line with the rest of the world gets weapons and decides they want to use those weapons to enforce it.
That's true.
I'm going to call every hero we talk about Al-Qaeda in this at some point. That just seems inevitable now.
Well, man, I don't think that's, like, okay, they're not Muslims or, you know, whatever, but I don't think that's far from the truth. Like, Batman is, you know, he's motivated by some far-off trauma that has become an ideological battle. Like, he seeks order and justice. I mean, like, you can't, that's not empirical. You can't put that on a piece of paper and, you know, associate metrics with it. It's order, justice, and I'm going to use violent means to get those ends. Like, have I described Al-Qaeda? Have I described that?
Well, it's also my clear solution, Batman's clear solution to get that order and justice is to get himself a tank and punch people, where he has a tremendous fortune. There are probably other ways one could spend those resources to make modicum improvements of justice.
That's true. I never. He's a billionaire. Like, you know, you could hire a lawyer and start a charity. I mean, you're going out beating up like random dudes. I never understood that. I mean, it's like a superhero problem. It's just like you're taking like this ideology and like this extreme belief in something, and then
wait.
It's odd to me.
It's just odd all around.
Like, I just as I'm getting older, I'm just like sitting here, just I'm critiquing comic books as I'm reading them and not enjoying them because I'm just like, okay, Lex Luthor, you become president. Good use of your money. Oh, you blow up Topeka to get at Batman or Superman. It's just like, it just pisses me off. I'm just like, you know, I really want DC to do like a, like it could just do a standalone series where like Lex Luthor actually acts like a corporate head. And, you know, he could still be obsessed and hate Superman. It's just we get to meet Lex Luthor's lawyers, lobbyists, you know, sharp communications guys who just, you know, are always on CNN, you know, just totally calling Superman a mass murderer or something awful, but I don't know.
Like The West Wing, but with Lex Luthor.
Oh. She is. Chelsea just gave me a note. One person's freedom fighter equal can also be another person's terrorist. Which makes sense. Like, Al-Qaeda, Batman. Batman's our hero, but he's really...
I read, it was an old Wolverine comic back in the day where there was a... This was just clearly, like, 80s, like, Contra kind of thing going on, where he helps out this Central American mutant who's La Bandera, whose power comes from, like, the valley of people she... the amount of people she's rallying with her, and she channels it through a flag and a beam, and it was, like, trying to turn that whole... Her mutant power was guerrilla war.
His whole mutant... That's kind of cool, I think.
But it was also... It was pretty heavy-handed. Comics, again, they're not policy shops.
I mean, it's the same way with, like, Star Wars, though. Like I think, like the ability to disseminate, like, a conversation about, you know, what does national security in the 21st century look like? I just think, like, Star Wars and even Game of Thrones does it better because comic books, like, it just seems like you could start off with a great story and then you go into, like, these weird extremes. Like The Boys, for instance. Like, Garth Ennis has a really great idea, like, you know, what happens when we need to control superheroes, and then just takes it to this weird place, or, like, what happens when the supervillain becomes the president, and it's just like...
Oh, well, clearly he's gonna blow up Topeka, at some point it's harder to find it into, like, a rationally consistent theme, and I granted, we're talking superheroes, so there's not always going to be that, but when you get, like, Game of Thrones, you have very clear political leaders with... constituencies with people they need to rely on. The quip about it is a sellsword walks into a room with a priest. It's like a priest, a king, and a merchant, and they all offer him. They offer, like, one offers himself, the priest offers him salvation, the king offers him knighthood, the merchant offers him money, but who has the actual power in that situation? It's the sellsword. There's the clear relationship there, because he's the one who's going to make the decision about which of those three.
Well, I think that conversation also, like, what's his name? Varys makes the point that power is an illusion. Like,
right.
Really, the choice, you're right, like, the choice does come down to the sellsword, but does he follow the seven, this is the gods in Game of Thrones, or does he, you know, follow gold, or does he follow political power? And I think that's something, like, really, like, that literature does a lot better than comic books and cartoons, is that, like, power is arbitrary, or at least, you know, what you choose to believe in, what you choose to allow control over you is completely arbitrary, like, whether it's the church, the castle, or stacks of gold.
And it's also something that a lot of pop poli-sci, or, like, cheap readings of history miss out, is we always get this inevitability, and we don't get that decisions are clearly made among these, like, people people clearly have the option to make many different choices at the time, and they're wondering why, like, or there's very different forces acting on them, or different possible motivations. You get really good deep state politics in Game of Thrones. You get patronage networks and competing interests, and why doesn't the king of the realm have control over all these other realms? When the patronage network, is it a tenuous peace? There's private armies, there's different militias, there's ungovernable parts of the world. And I think that will do you far better for understanding Pakistan than about half the things written on Pakistan in the last decade.
That's true. Like, when you read, like, Game of Thrones, like it's really interesting. Like, before Bob Baratheon, the king, before he dies, like, if you read, like, more deeply into, like, the relationships, it's basically he's being bankrolled or underwritten, is more accurate. Yeah. You know, he's being underwritten by the Lannisters, who then, you know, give their daughter to him, and then there's this tight, you know, relationship between power, you know, the power of the king and the finances, and then when he dies and everything goes to, you know, hell really quickly, you know, it's the idea that you really can't base a state or a, you know, a system of governance on one personality and one set of relationships, because suddenly, you know, it's a mad scramble, you know, the Lannisters come to power, and then it's this, you know, civil war in the north, and then a civil war in the south, and it's just...
Right, and you get, also, in that you have strong, strong patronage networks and competing chains of authority, but you don't have institutions, hardly. Mm-hmm. Like, the one pan-national institution is the Night's Watch, which is the one whose purpose really encompasses the whole of the realm. Everyone else is playing politics, and there's one force there designed to save them from an existential threat.
But everybody ignores it.
But everybody ignores them, as happens with existential threats in this world, if the temperatures are any indication. Anyway, but it's the kind of thing. Instead of them pointing a laser down at Earth, they're sitting at the wall fighting through the actual battles.
That's what I also find interesting, like, from our conversation about nukes, that Daenerys has three really powerful creatures. And, like, if you get into the fifth book, like, a large part of the fifth book is basically one of her dragons commits murder or eats a child. And so Daenerys has to come to this, you know, idea that she has to start controlling her dragons. You know, this is after, you know, in the third book, where basically they use the dragons to, you know, create political power over these eastern kingdoms, these, Meereen and some other, I don't remember their names. But I mean, like, back to our original point that, you know, the idea that, you know, she doesn't have this really robust command and control system over the dragons, and suddenly, you know, it's this really powerful weapon on sheath. Like, it's, you know, it's basically doing what a dragon does and eats, set things on fire, eat, repeat.
And that's what people fear from autonomous weapons. And humans have experimented with them over the past century with biological warfare, primarily. That we've tried, like, biological and chemical warfare. And chemical one, at least, most chemical weapons ever used, given enough wind, will dissipate to non-harmful portions. So that's not terribly something. It's not the most useful weapon, but it won't actively try and seek you out and kill you, where biological weapons entirely can. Biological weapons aren't really used, if people have the capacity to make them, because once you make a virus that kills people, or a bacterium that's really good at seeking out and killing people, it's hard to tell it which people to kill.
Now I'm thinking of StarCraft. I'm thinking of the Zerg.
as you should be.
like this is also my problem with the space genre, is that you never deal with biology. Like, in Star Wars, there's no... Like, I just wanted, like, a Zerg-like race, where everything is... They don't believe in, you know, mechanical things. Everything is grown genetically, you know, weird...
I think the Yuuzhan Vong might be like that, but I'm not that good on my expanded universe. They might introduce something like that later to go deeper nerd than this, than expanded universe Star Wars, in Warhammer 40K, which serves as partially the inspiration for StarCraft, but they had the Tyranids, and where all the rest of the universe is several warlike species fighting for territory, or territory, or in one case, slaves, the Tyranid swarms just pass through the galaxy eating everything. That is their purpose, is just to consume and absorb other life. And so where other ones, there's like there's states or clans or tribes or the Empire.
Just eat.
They have swarms that pass through and either eat everything or get destroyed on their way. And that's just their philosophy, and they're just kind of a terror lurking out there that occasionally shows up and wrecks your shit.
I mean, it's like, but the thing with, like, biological, like, not just, like, biological weapons, though, it's, you know, I think with biology versus, like, an IED. Like, if you take a bacteria or a zergling and you, you know, put it against an IED, is that an IED is always consistent. You know, it always explodes and will always kill somebody. You know, you'll lose an arm, you'll be maimed. But, like, with bacteria, you know, I think, as somebody who, you know, I've read enough biology books, but it just seems like, A, you know, you might get infected, but you might not die. So you might, you know, stress about, you know, the infrastructure, but somebody gets the flu and, you know, they don't die. And then with the Zergling, like, all I can think about is, I think in, was it StarCraft 1 or 2, they have, like, you know, I think it's in 1 where the, you know, a level opens up where guys are basically hunting Zerglings.
Yes.
Like, they're just going out and shooting it, and it's just like, what's the difference between a Zergling and a bunny rabbit? You know, besides snarling teeth and...
besides lethality?
I mean, but you can... The idea is that you
very
can...
Very sharp teeth.
You could shoot a Zergling. Like, it's...
Yeah.
You take out its brain and suddenly it doesn't...
Right, no, animals are certainly... And animals have been... Yeah. Those, at that point...
Well, I mean, it's like the weakness of a biological system is that, you know, it's much harder to knock it, you know, knock down a drone or an Abrams tank versus, you know, to... You know, biology has the advantage of mass. It doesn't necessarily have the advantage of armor. You know what I mean? Like, there's 6 billion people.
Right.
But you don't necessarily have 6 billion bullets or, you know, enough nukes to... You know what I mean? Like, you know...
Yeah, no, certainly. There's, there are weapons that are significantly... They work at different levels. Though I think it's worth separating apart, as you did, the Zergling from the bacteria. Because the bacterium can self-replicate, which is the other part that's scary. Is that that will self-replicate and spread as it becomes more successful. And so that's one that, at some point, you just put a disease out there as your biological weapon attack and then just hope it never comes back to get you. Whereas the animals are at least somewhat directed. I mean, we haven't used Zerglings at war, but we've used elephants, or we've had attack dogs, or things, and those.
But isn't sort of that's the issue then, using biology is that, in sort of StarCraft, you know, okay, disclosure, I've been playing a lot more. I just bought StarCraft 2 and I'm working through the game, so that's why. I apologize.
It's okay. It's pretty great.
But I mean, it seems like with biology, you definitely need a tighter... You can't really decentralize control. Like, if you lose control of that elephant, dog, or as in the video game, if you lose control of hundreds of millions of Zerglings, like, suddenly it's, you know, absolute chaos. Where I think with, you know, if you are not piloting the tank, then it's not an autonomous weapon. You can't... It doesn't move, it doesn't fire, it doesn't... Can't be used. You know what I mean? Like,
absolutely. Or the drone will run out of fuel and, at least currently, cannot refuel itself, whereas a attack dog or a Zergling, if you will, something like that, would be able to at least sustain itself. Weapons that can provide their own fuel and keep going and exist outside a command structure. In fact, the entire first one of the campaigns, I think it's in... I know in both Brood War and the original StarCraft before the expansion concern the control nodes of the Zerg swarm.
Well, I mean, yeah, you're right. Like, after the first game, you kill the Overmind, and then suddenly, like, the Overmind was the brain, and then suddenly everybody, after they're dead, all the Zerg go nuts.
Right.
And they start eating themselves and expanding... And then eating themselves, and then attacking, and then they... I think it was in the expansion of the second game where, basically, like this is, like, causes the rise of Sarah Kerrigan, like that.
Right.
The lady, the...
The Brood Queen.
Or whatever she's called, but...
Queen of Blades, that's it.
Yeah. But I mean, like, it's just, like, you know, I mean, biology is definitely a fearsome thing. It's just, it just seems like, you know, it's not very much a reliable weapon. Or it's, not until we get into super genetics and...
Right, well, it's also, it exists outside, or it's harder to... Command and control has, there are things you can do with command and control in algorithms and machines that you just can't do with people. It's why a drone will respond to commands where a person with a gun won't always. And we're comfortable with the person with the gun because we have a long history of that. And especially in the U.S., we have a really strong tradition and establishment of command and control. We don't have to worry about, like, private armies splitting off and marauding them around like other or acting on their own once we arm them and just going off and doing horrible things. We don't really have to worry about that. We have a very strong chain of command. But the person still has the autonomy, whereas a drone cannot do that. Or people, like, you just... That's the limit of the weapon.
But, I mean, you can also... I think you're right. And I think the more fearsome thing is that, like, if you're trained on a drone, you can't necessarily take your skill set outside of the pilot's room. Right, if you're like Eric Prince, like the head of Blackwater, you could take your skill set of organizing, you know, your connections, and literally, you know, after you leave the Navy, start your own company, and right. Basically, you know, find other like-minded individuals and build a, you know, an organization like Blackwater or Z Services or whatever they're calling themselves. But I mean, but it's really weird. Like, I think you've hit an interesting point that people are more scared of drones. Or, you know, these fancy weapon systems and don't realize, like, you know, they don't really pay attention to the underlying infrastructure and idea that really, you know, the most fearsome thing is the idea or the propagation of the idea or the, you know, organization. You fundamentally changed, you know, legal and, you know, financial organization to where anybody with an idea and a skill set could, you know, sell their services. Potentially. Now that we're, you know, to switch gears a little from, you know, to combine drones and biology with, you know, sort of cyber war, this is, you know, a point of a lot of contention because, you know, we haven't even sort of defined, is it really war, is it not war, where does cyber involve? But it seems like it's the elements of the idea of an ultimate weapon and the idea of, you know, not being able to control individuals who know, you know, who have enough knowledge with computers and enough knowledge with programming to sort of go out into the wild and mess with things. But, I mean, but I still think the state has a lot more leverage in that case, though.
It definitely does. I mean...
If you think about, like, Stuxnet, right? So...
Right.
And the, you know, the sort of derivatives of Stuxnet were all created, you know, allegedly... Because we don't know yet. They're all created by states, whereas it seems like with individuals, most individuals are either sneaks who want to look at your data but not do anything with it, or, you know, they just want to, you know, hack your credit card and buy cocaine and guns. Or, you know, these botnets.
I mean, yeah, thieves are...
Criminal networks.
There's actually, I think Bob Gourley made the argument recently, or threw out there as an idea that Stuxnet might look back on Stuxnet as the first autonomous weapon, as a truly autonomous weapon, which is an interesting thing to think about, as it was code that could restart itself and remain hidden and decide when to strike and operated without command. The command given to Stuxnet was someone surreptitiously plugging a USB into the system that brought the virus there. And that was the extent of control that the attacker had over Stuxnet, was putting it there. Which is actually a lot, like what a biological weapon would be you drop the virus and run. You leave it to wreck its
havoc. It's like 12 Monkeys, where Brad Pitt just goes into the airport. Is it 12 Monkeys?
I think it's 12 Monkeys.
And then there was another virus movie. I can't think of it right now, but... Planet of the Apes, where the movie ends where... The person is infected, and then it's like, oh, they're traveling to China, or was it? Planet? I don't know. Let's just say Contagion. Like you watch like a bunch of movies in a row, and then suddenly it's all like mishmash. suddenly it's a monkey doctor trying to solve a mystery with Matt Damon. It's
like, and what? Time travel?
And yeah. Time travel. Doc, Doc, I'm back! What? Monkey Michael Fox? Anyway.
Oh, the thing science fiction lets you do. But no, but with Cyberwar, actually, Skyfall, not sure if you've seen it yet, but there's a big, yeah, there's a strong component of Cyberwar to it, which is done by a non-state actor who's actually, Silva, he's mentioned in the,
the greatest super villain. So this guy has enough money to hack an island, have everybody leave the island, but has decided to kill MI6. Like, he has his own island. I don't understand why he could have... I don't even know what he could have done, but...
I mean, he was a revenge quest. What's weird is that someone didn't use that revenge quest to then, say, use his drive to take out MI6 as the first step in launching, like, a way to knock out England. Or to wipe that out, which would have been something you could do, because he would have made an excellent henchman. He had really skilled... deep, deep revenge motivation, and somehow managed to attract a horde of minions, despite it being a very personal revenge quest.
That's true. Never understood that.
That's part of the flaw of the narrative.
But I mean, it's like, it goes back to the superhero problem. It's Bond. You can't have complex, realistic, like, plots because, you know, it's Bond, or it's Superman, or it's Batman. They're not equipped to deal with these complex political issues. But no, I like that idea. Like, the movie would have been so much better if it was just a guy who basically wanted to take out or weaken England enough to either rise to power or become some sort of financial mogul. Because that to me makes sense. Like, oh, you want to be a billionaire or you want to be on the throne.
Or say you set it up where his whole plan is to knock out his... He's got the revenge quest against M of MI6. That's his deal. Fine. You use that to create a series of attacks that threaten England, that have the intelligence service itself hiding, and you just screw up the English financial sector, and you have your own new brand new banks take over, and suddenly the world stops banking in England. That would have been a plot where he could have been a valuable henchman in service to someone else who had an actual... and a positive ambition, because that could motivate more people, or at least would attract henchmen.
That would have been awesome.
You should play Evil Genius at some point.
I want to write a complaint letter to DC. Be like, I'm an educated man, I can write, I have enough experience in DC and corporate America and nonprofits, I could write a really convincing lobby, where your villain, I would write it in such a way that the lobbyists and the lawyers and the comm guys are sympathetic. You're like, wow, these guys are just doing a job. Banality of evil. What?
And you can do it really well. And you can also, like... It's really easy to write a story where you're sympathetic with not the superhero, because that's any story in which there's a supervillain. Because you just have to, like, oh... this person operates without constraint and could kill you by looking at you with their laser eyes. That's not something you just kind of want to walk around with unless you've got a lot of confidence in their ability.
Which I never understood the laser eyes. Like, from a science point of view, like your eye tissue is really sensitive.
He's not human.
Oh, right, he's Kryptonian.
They're weird.
And what if he's, like, really staring intently at something? Like, I always worry... like, what if he's playing with the dog and staring intently at the dog, and suddenly the dog explodes?
I mean, that's the best part of the side bits of X-Men, is always you have the child mutants who can't control their things, and then sometimes comical, sometimes horrible things happen as their powers just lash out.
I think we have enough. Just remember to look at blogtarkin.com. That's blogtarkin.com, one word. Also, check us out on Twitter @the_boy and @rejectionking.
And if you think about these science fictiony things, feel free to send me a line, and we are more than happy to run all sorts of pieces about science fiction and strategy and poli-sci-fi.
Excellent.